The irony of looking at this passage today is really hitting me over the head. Passage about people who could not stay awake for just one lousy hour. And a passage about all the men fleeing. It's good to see all of you ladies. So if you weren't here last week, no big deal. You only missed the trial and crucifixion of the Lord. And then Christ's final Thursday, what we're looking at now, has another set of incomparably profound critical stories for our faith, including the Last Supper and his last few moments of freedom in the Garden of Gethsemane, that in Mark, and only in Mark, features for some reason, without any warning, some random guy who ends up naked running through the middle of the scene. I reread this passage a few weeks ago, and I said, I've never heard a sermon that had anything to say about that guy. More on him in a minute. But first, let's talk about some about Jesus and his friends. Shout out to Tracy Truesdale for this reference. She sent Haley and I a link on Sunday. So the comedian John Mulaney, anyone know John Mulaney? Yes, indeed. He was recently the host of the show Saturday Night Live. If you don't know who John Mulaney is, don't worry. He's new in town. And then, in his opening monologue at the beginning of the show, Mulaney happened to bring up the subject of Jesus and his friends. He said, "It's hard to make friends when you're an adult male. I think that's the greatest miracle of Jesus. He was a 33-year-old man, and he had not one, but 12 best friends. And they were not his wife's friends' husbands, like all of our dad's friends, and he didn't meet them a long time ago in school. He met them in his 30s. And they were all his best friends, and he'd do magic tricks for them, and they loved him for it. Except for the one time when he really should have done magic, and he forgot to. That must have been disappointing for his 12 best friends. They're taking him away in chains, and they're like, do the chain trick, do the chain trick. And Jesus is like, I don't know, I don't know. So a couple of things to think about there. A, I am quite certain that Jesus actually had even more best friends than that. The rest of them just happened to all be named Mary. Mary Magdalene, Mary of Mary and Martha, his mom. But the gospel writers were products of their time, so as far as the written record is concerned, those women weren't part of the inner circle. As for the 12 who were, whatever shall we say about them? For one thing, I think John Mulaney is right, that in a way, Jesus' greatest miracle was the fact that he was their friend. He loved these guys, chose to share his life with them. He spends a lot of time with them. They go fishing like every weekend. They're always on the boat together. Everyone gets to know each other really well, and he's got a whole lot of work to do at the same time, but he's always inviting them to join him and to learn from him and even help out because he's on message. And the heart of his work is about relationships. It's about recalling that life is a gift from God, especially the other people in ours. And at the end of the day, what matters most is seeing the face of God in one another and allowing ourselves to love whom we see. That's how Jesus chooses to spend his time. And by this point in the story, it's very clear that he has other options. He has legions of fans. He can raise people from the dead. He can control wind and water. And then in this grand mountaintop unveiling, we've seen that he is greater and more powerful than all the legendary heroes from his people's past. He can start glowing on command. Jesus has the means to do whatever he wants to do. Yet what he values more than anything else in all this world are his connections with others including these 12. People from all kinds of backgrounds, some of which are categorically disreputable or undignified within their cultural setting. Regular people with shortcomings, just like anybody else, such as how these guys rarely understand anything he's talking about. People who sometimes completely lose their minds or their religion. One of them pulls out a sword in the middle of a garden and starts dismembering folks right in front of Jesus, who has been preaching against violence for, I don't know, a few years now. And what are any of them doing with swords in the middle of a garden anyway? And then you've got this poor man who's just a servant of the high priest who loses an ear thanks to one of this pacifist's disciples. People capable of failure. These folks that are incapable of doing the one stinking thing Jesus asked them to do the last night of his earthly life, and it wasn't even hard. He just wanted them to stay up with him for a few lousy extra hours, but only one of them can pull it off, and that's because he's somewhere else, literally selling him out to the people who want to kill him. God's chosen one looks at these regular, confused, occasionally irrational, flawed human beings and doesn't see failure. Doesn't see flaws. He sees children of God, worthy of everything he's got. Friends whom he loves dearly. And I think that's a miracle. And for Jesus, there doesn't seem to be anything about them or anything they could ever do to possibly change that, even if they desert him in his hour of greatest need. Which is about as painful of an experience as I can imagine. Not to underplay what is to come tomorrow, but the emotional damage of being abandoned by everyone who you thought cared about you when you need your friends the most. And they all do. Judas is the only one of the 12 that hands him over to his enemies, but for one reason or another, they each abandon him. And we don't exactly know what each of those reasons are, but put yourself in the disciples' shoes, and it doesn't take a lot of creativity at all to come up with some very reasonable reasons. The same things that have been severing human relationships for a long time. A, it's a terrifying situation. You'd have to have been sleeping through the whole thing not to be scared out of your mind. You've got an angry mob summoned by religious leaders in the middle of the night. No, thank you. Perhaps some of the 12 are angry with him. I mean, he can walk on water. So why didn't he do the chain trick? We worked so hard on it. And imagine the disappointment. Some of these guys left families, their jobs, to follow him. They've put a lot of what they had into this as well, convinced that something was special about him, even if they couldn't always understand what he was talking about, convinced that he was someone or something that could and would change the way this messed up world works, only to see him either quit or abjectly fail, carted off like a common criminal. It's like when all this time you were positive that little David's got this, he's going to win, but it turns out that Goliath knows how to catch rocks. It's crushing. So they all leave him. Even the ones who really, really, really promise they won't. It is an old story. Despite the unique elements here, at the same time, this is a tale as old as humankind itself. It goes right back to another story and another garden. When everything is great, you've got Adam and Eve, everything is great. And then they do cross a line with the whole fruit thing. But I don't believe their story is a lesson on dietary restrictions or even blindly obeying God. In Genesis, Eden fades away when we forget what life is intended to be. When we started turning our backs on each other, when one of us points a finger at the other and says, "Well, she made me do it." And they run away naked, ducking for cover, rather than remembering that the Creator of all things made us to cherish and uplift one another. And this is where I think the naked guy comes in. That he's like an echo from long ago, from the advent of our world that was meant to be filled with courage and kindness and peace, but instead there was brokenness almost as soon as things began, and that brokenness has lingered. So here we are once again, another garden scene, another moment when fear and all the other raw feelings that come between us are very present, are on the run. It's poetry. And it makes the Easter story just that much more poetic. It's by the end of this, 2 days after he's crucified, early in the morning, some of his disciples, the ones all named Mary, they go to his tomb. And when they get there, the stone is rolled away and the body isn't there. And depending on which gospel you're reading, these women are met instead with someone they weren't expecting. In Matthew, it's an angel. In Luke, it's two angelic-looking folks. But in Mark, the women come into the tomb, and it's no angel. It's a young man who's no longer running around naked. He's calm. He's clothed. He's sitting, unafraid, dignified, restored, with a message for all of Jesus' friends, that not only does he live again, but he is back in Galilee waiting on them, waiting on Peter and the rest of them to hurry up and meet up with him back at their old stomping grounds, because his people, or his love for his people, even the friends who all turned their backs on him when he needed them most, that love never died. And it has overcome all the brokenness that has been tearing us apart since the very beginning. Thanks be to God. Amen.